Okay. So anyone have any questions before we begin? This is the third lecture on the Kennedy period. Very, very important period in the history of the Cold War. It's the great watershed period. And it's complex. That's why it's taking such a long time to kind of get through it. Why is it important? Because this is yet another attempt to reach a political settlement, to establish the basis for a stable international order, a system both sides could accept and which would enable the two major powers, along with everyone else, to kind of live with each other in peace, to kind of coexist, to go their separate ways without locking horns with each other. Okay? You look at the policy that the Kennedy administration adopted when it came to power in January of 1961, especially President Kennedy himself. Say, it really seems like there's a chance that they could work things out with the Soviets. You know, the rhetoric that was used in the Kennedy inaugural address, you know, very ideological. You know, we will bear any burden. You know, we will pay any price. You know, it's like the real Kennedy was not cut from that cloth at all. It's very, very cool. Unideological type. You know, you looked at the interests of the Soviet Union, looked at the interests of the United States, and you said, there's no reason why we can't reach an agreement that would provide for a stable international system. You know, there's no huge difference in interests that would warrant running any serious risk of a general nuclear war. We should be able to work things out with them. We're a great power. They're a great power. We could relate to each other on that basis, on a business-like basis, on a basis of mutual respect for each other's kind of core interests as defined in power political terms. So his policies, he laid it out when he met with Khrushchev in Vienna in June of 1961, We respect your fundamental interests. We understand your special position in Eastern Europe. We respect that. We also understand your concerns about Germany, and especially, implicitly about the German nuclear issue. We're willing to accommodate in that area. Just as we respect your interests, you got to respect ours. And in particular, you have to respect our position in Berlin, because our whole position in Europe as a whole, and indeed, therefore, in the world as a whole, is very much bound up with our presence in West Berlin. You know, so basically, let's strike a deal. Let's everyone accept the status quo, of a divided Berlin with the Western half under the military protection of the three Western powers and them alone, and but also the status quo of a non-nuclear West German state under the military protection, again, of the United States and the other Western powers, the NATO system. And you'd think, and I'm sure Kennedy must have thought this, that presented with this policy, the Soviets would wrap things up, but they didn't. You see, what made that policy possible? What was going on in the U.S. side? Kennedy had dramatically transformed U.S. policy from what it had been under Eisenhower. What is the nature of that transformation? Is it a shift in military strategy away from the Eisenhower policy of massive retaliation to this much more balanced, intelligent policy of flexible response? That's one of these chestnuts that you find in all these textbooks. In reality, the shift in that area is very minor. A military policy did not change in any truly fundamental way. The whole notion that the Eisenhower policy was to, you know, if we're challenged in any minor way, then it's kind of execute the war plans and, you know, launch a third world war. It's just nonsense. That wasn't their thinking at all. And similarly, on to Kennedy, it wasn't as though they were now afraid to use nuclear weapons. It was still a strategy of nuclear escalation or a gradual escalation up to the level of nuclear weapons. You know, they go a little bit further onto Kennedy. You know, under Eisenhower, they would go up to the single division level before they went nuclear. For Kennedy, it was three divisions. That's not a fundamental change. Right? And even at the nuclear level, under Eisenhower, the strategy was, you know, in the event of general war, we'd shoot off everything at once. Massive, concentrated, extremely rapid nuclear strike. There was a one and only one plan for general nuclear war. It's called the SIOP, Single Integrated Operational Plan. And, you know, in this world, they always speak in terms of these acronyms, so it's called the SIOP. And that was the plan the Eisenhower administration had for fighting a nuclear war. Under Kennedy, the rhetoric was that we were moving away from that and opting for a policy of controlled and discriminate general nuclear war fighting. And that it would be a strategy of that looked toward a protracted nuclear war in which we would take care to avoid collateral damage. We would focus on the other side's strategic forces. We would try to avoid harming civilians in the other side's cities. In fact, this was rhetoric, not reality. The war plans did not change in any fundamental way. They did not build the sort of infrastructure that could operate in a nuclear environment and allow the political authorities to control the course of a protracted nuclear war. They didn't believe in it. But they adopted this rhetoric for instrumental purposes. Again, so this whole notion that there was a fundamental shift from Eisenhower to Kennedy in the military area is really... has very little basis. But there was a shift, and it was in the political area, and above all, in terms of American policy toward Europe, American policy on all these NATO questions, European questions. What was the shift? Eisenhower wanted to pull out of Europe. He wanted the Europeans ultimately to be able to defend themselves. He wanted them to pull together in a kind of United States of Europe, independent of the United States, you know, with able to balance Soviet power on their own, implying that they would have to build nuclear forces of their own, under their own control, hopefully on as united a basis as possible. But if all you could hope for was national nuclear forces, which were kind of knit together in some sort of international framework, you know, the NATO framework, as the American involvement in Europe diminished and gradually went down to zero, NATO would devolve into a purely European, meaning West European, defense system. If that's the most you can get, kind of a knitting together of these national forces, that's fine too, because we want to get out, right? And we want the Europeans to defend themselves, right? Kennedy and his top assistants, they did not believe that approach was viable. Pie in the sky. These Europeans, there's no really purely European solution to the European defense problem. Okay? America has to stay in because, you know, for the Europeans to defend themselves, they're going to have to build nuclear weapons. That means German nuclear weapons. But once you talk about a German finger on the nuclear trigger, given Germany's revisionist aspirations, the fact that they don't accept the division of their country, they're forced into a moderate policy as long as they're weak and non-nuclear and dependent on the other Western powers for protection. Germany becomes a nuclear power. It's going to totally transform everything. We can't do that. The Soviets will move preemptively to kind of... head off that danger. So there's a risk of war in that regard too. The other Europeans don't like the idea of a nuclear-armed Germany, even less than the Americans do. You know, it'll break the Atlantic Alliance. We can't go that route, right? So the Americans have to stay in. There has to be a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. Only a system whose backbone is American power can provide it. That's the Kennedy approach. You know, it's like this is the obvious inference to be drawn from a study of the whole history of the 1950s and how the Eisenhower approach and Eisenhower's lax attitude, as the Kennedy people saw it, about nuclear weapons. This is one of the things that was upsetting the apple cart, all this talk about the United States withdrawing from Europe, Europeans defending themselves. This was not the way to go for the Kennedy period. You know, it's like we have no choice but to remain involved. We're stuck there. We're trapped there. And given that that's the case, you know, given that we have to pay this price, to carry this enormous burden of defense of Western Europe, and a particularly great burden, given that everyone thinks the Soviets are going to develop a survivable nuclear force, and when that happens, the Americans can't threaten to escalate to the level of a general nuclear war, and then the nuclear umbrella that we're providing for Europe is going to be threadbare. Yeah? It means that no matter how hard and how fast and how massively we attack the Soviet Union in the beginning of a war, we'll wipe out a lot of stuff, but no matter how massive that attack, they'll still have enough left, you know, that survives that attack to go on and launch a counterattack that would destroy American society. That's what we call, they call a second strike capability. A survivable capability. It'll survive the U.S. attack, they'll ride it out, and then they'll go. The opposite of that is a first strike capability on the part of the United States. If we wipe out so much stuff that they can't launch an effective counterattack, a counterattack that would cause really heavy damage to American society, right? Everyone sees it coming. In fact, does come in the summer of 1963. Kennedy is briefed that American nuclear superiority is a thing of the past. But everyone knows it's coming. And so how are we going to defend Western Europe in that sort of strategic environment? If we can't threaten nuclear escalation, it's our ability to kind of defend them through non-nuclear means is problematic, especially since what if they limit their nuclear attack to Western Europe? You know, are we going to commit national suicide and respond to that? It weakens, our position, our military position is weak. We see this coming. If we're going to be responsible for the defense of Western Europe, we have a right to certain things in exchange. We have the right, Kennedy view was, to control the sort of foreign policy the West as a whole was pursuing. You know, unlike Eisenhower, who deferred to the Europeans, he viewed himself as this kind of mediator. Well, Kennedy was going to lay down the law. You know, the Europeans, he says, they have to, come along or fall behind. Right? We're going to call the shots politically on all these kind of core issues, these issues relating to Berlin, Germany, German nuclear weapons, all these kinds of things. We are going to decide these things. Right? And we have a right to do that because of the fact that our own necks are on the chopping block, or soon will be. And very dramatic change. A change on the whole issue of nuclear sharing and helping the Europeans get nuclear weapons under Kennedy. If we want to call the shots, we want to centralize control over the military forces of the West. We want to decide the Western... how the West conducts itself in its dealings with the Soviet Union, obviously in the military area, and if we control the use of force, that will also enable us to control the political side of our relationship with the Soviets, what sort of negotiations are conducted and so on. It's like the United States should control all these things, right? And so the keynote of the Kennedy policy is centralization of control. Under Eisenhower, we wanted the Europeans to be able to defend themselves. We had all kinds of reasons for encouraging them, helping them to develop a certain nuclear capability. Allowing them to use these American nuclear weapons. You know, they took care to make sure that these custody arrangements were just a sham because they wanted to make sure the Europeans had effective control of nuclear weapons. We wanted to encourage them to build up a nuclear infrastructure. For Eisenhower, even the Germans. Kennedy policy, absolutely out of the question that we would want West Germany ever to have control of nuclear forces of her own. And from those basic postulates, all kinds of conclusions followed. Again, this dramatic transformation in NATO military policy during the Kennedy period. This is the tightening up of control. And last time I told you about all these acronyms. CQ, that means command, control, and communications. This is to make sure that a communication and command and control system was robust enough so that in the event of a war, the forces in the field couldn't use their weapons without direct authorization from the political authorities in Washington. This went hand in hand with the PALs, permissive action links. These are these locks they put on nuclear weapons. You couldn't use these things without codes. So this was the way you would implement a system where the forces in the field would be prevented from using nuclear weapons without direct authorization from the political leadership. Right? They would need the codes. The codes could only be released when the political authorities decided to release them. The whole position of the NATO commander, SACUR, dramatically changed. As a matter of fact, this led to the firing of the General Norstad, the NATO commander, by the Kennedy people in 1962. You remember under Eisenhower how there had been this whole system for the pre-delegation of authority to use nuclear weapons to top military commanders like SACUR? And this was the basis of SACUR's power. You know, he wasn't just an ordinary American general. But now, under Kennedy, SACUR's wings were clipped, is the expression. He was racked back to the level of an ordinary American field commander. He no longer had this pre-delegated authority to use nuclear weapons on his own, essentially. They didn't want to take any chances. MRBMs, just finish the whole list and then we could. MRBMs, medium range ballistic missiles, to be based on the territory of the European countries, would have had a certain deterrent effect, just like the deployment of Soviet missiles in Cuba had a certain deterrent effect when the Americans were contemplating invasion of Cuba. The deployment of nuclear-tipped missiles capable of hitting your homeland in a particular piece of territory is going to deter you to a certain extent. It's not, the effect is not absolute. It's going to deter you from attacking that territory. That's why the Europeans and the NATO authorities, like General Norstad, wanted to deploy these MRBMs. Now we don't want to do it because we're afraid the Europeans are going to get control of these American strategic weapons. And instead, we proposed this plan for the MLF, the Multilateral Force. The French called it the Multilateral Farce, and that's not far from the truth, because these were weapons that couldn't be used without American authorization. They were subject to an American veto. So what were the Europeans getting from this? Nothing. You know, even in technical military terms, they weren't worth very much. British and French nuclear weapons, we were helping the British. Eisenhower wanted to help the French. Now, under Kennedy, we turn against British and French nuclear forces. Why do we do that? You say, no one cares about the British and French nuclear forces if in their own terms. And if we had the guarantee that it would just end there, you know, they would have gone ahead with this. The problem is that if you support the French nuclear program, how are you going to say no to the Germans? And if you say no to the Germans, you know, they'll really resent it because you're discriminating against them. So you got to say no to the French. And then if you say no to the French, you can't go on having this relationship with the British. And so you also have to say no to the British. You know, get the British out of the nuclear business. This was the phrase that was actually used within the government in 1961. And as I said before, nuclear doctrine, now it's like all this controlled nuclear war fighting ideas. This is for the public. It's for the rest of the world. It's not reflected in what they're doing operationally. They're doing it for instrumental purposes. It's like, oh, well, if you believe, you know, the whole notion of a controlled nuclear war implies that control has to be centralized. You can't have a controlled nuclear war if the Americans are fighting it their way and the British are fighting it their way and the French are fighting it their way and whatever. You know, if policy only makes sense, if there's centralized control. Well, that's the whole function of the doctrine, to provide a plausible rationale in the eyes of many people for the strategy of centralizing control in American hands. They don't take any of this stuff seriously. Anyway, so there's a dramatic shift in U.S. policy from Eisenhower to Kennedy. You know, tightening up control over NATO, keeping Germany non-nuclear. Okay, so...
How centralized was the distribution? How high in the hierarchy in the United States would the decision process have to go before the decision?
Oh, basically at the level of the president. It's like they wanted to kind of pull all the strings in their own hands. And President Kennedy was very deeply involved in these operational issues. And this, as a matter of fact, this created this big crisis in civil-military relations in the United States during the Kennedy period, because the military had been used to having their expertise respected, not having these civilians, intruding and asking all these questions about what are you going to do in this case and what are you going to do in that case. And they deeply resented this.
How does this compare to what the Soviet Union was doing in this regard and what the U.S. knew about what the Soviet Union
In the Soviet Union, the political leadership by and large did not intrude all that much in operational military matters. It just kind of, you know, signed the checks basically and let the military do what it wanted to do. They also had doctrine which was articulated in the public for various political effects, but the reality was that the professional military, it was an important interest group in the Soviet establishment. Right? It played a key role in enabling Khrushchev to hold on to power in 1957, also in the whole immediate post-Stalin period when Beria was prevented from coming to power in the Soviet Union. That was thanks to the political actions of the Soviet military. So much more autonomous in domestic political terms within the Soviet Union than the counterparts were even in the United States. But this didn't prevent Kennedy from wanting to, you know, limit their autonomy yet further. They very much want the president and his top advisors to control things, both within the U.S. national security establishment and in the Western alliance as a whole. Control things militarily, and that meant also controlling things politically. You know, America's in, and we want to keep Germany non-nuclear. And all these other things follow from that. Okay? How are you going to do it? You may want to have peace on that basis. You may want to kind of approach the Soviets and say, what we envision is a world, you control your part of Europe, we'll control ours, we'll keep Germany down, everyone respects the status quo of a Europe under the thumb of the two superpowers. But to say that that's what you want and to achieve that goal, oh, there's quite a gap. And there are these two huge sets of problems. One has to do with getting the allies to go along with it. Because you're basically telling these great nations with long histories that you want them to be ciphers politically, zeros politically. You know, it's like, you know, we're talking about your continent, your national survival, but we want to make all the decisions. We don't want you to have any control over your own destiny, and the proof of that is we want to keep you from having nuclear weapons, because there's no way you can take an independent line politically if you can't stand up to a great power like the Soviet Union by having nuclear weapons of your own. So you're going to be totally dependent on us militarily, therefore you're going to have to be totally dependent on us politically. You know, are they going to accept that? Germans, the French, the British? It's like, well, a lot of resentment in Europe when this policy was adopted in the early Kennedy period. Could you force them to accept it? Well, that was the whole notion. Yeah, final analysis, they're utterly dependent on America for their survival, for their security. They'll have to do what we want. If they don't do, we'll threaten to withdraw. Well, not quite that simple. Would we really want to withdraw? You know, if withdrawal means the Soviets taking over all of Europe, we might be reluctant to withdraw no matter what line the Europeans took. And if we're reluctant to withdraw, wouldn't the Europeans know that? And if they assumed that the United States was a serious country that had a serious foreign policy, you know, based on its national interests and thought in power political terms, they could defy us with impunity. And so our ability to make a credible threat of withdrawal depended on the defects of our own political system, the fact that they couldn't really trust us to behave rationally in power political terms, giving us an incentive, kind of, to feign a degree of irrationality. You can see how this kind of corrupts the whole nature of the relationship. Still, we have this sense of push comes to shove, we can get them to fall into line. And they're quite overt about saying things like this. That's only half of the problem. As I said, they have to fight this war on two fronts. You know, getting the NATO allies to fall in behind this policy, not an easy thing. And also getting the Soviets to accept. And here, the problem was that movement in this direction was taken as a sign of weakness on the part of the Soviets. Look at all these concessions the Americans want to make. All these efforts to reach a settlement. Well, this amounted to an abandonment of all these positions that the West had held on to during the Eisenhower period. You know, it's like Kennedy people pretty much they're willing to accept the status quo in Germany. It meant recognition of East Germany, something that had been anathema prior to that point, you know, recognition of Eastern Europe as Soviet sphere of influence. Soviets don't want West Germany to go nuclear. Oh, we're going to keep them from going nuclear. You know, all these things are like major concessions given what American policy had been. Khrushchev looks at this and he says, well, you know, why are they making these concessions? They're scared of a war. They're fooling all of themselves now to avoid a war. And so, if that's the case, and we've gotten so much just by, you know, raising the prospect of a war, we should continue that policy. No need to kind of wrap things up with the West. And so late 61, early 62, the Kennedy administration proposes its increasingly formal terms, its ideas about how for a settlement, most notably in the Principles document of March of 1962. Soviets don't wrap things up. They accept the concessions, but they don't want to give anything of their own in exchange. You know, and so the Americans have become increasingly enraged by all this in the course of the summer of 1962. And this is Khrushchev pretty much says that we'll wait until after the midterm elections in November of 62, and then after that we're going to push the our Berlin demands again. So Kennedy sees the a crisis, confrontation, as inevitable. Right? Whenever that happens, a whole other set of considerations kicks in. If war is inevitable, maybe, or a crisis is inevitable, maybe we should have it when we are relatively strong rather than waiting until we're relatively weak. They know American nuclear superiority soon will be a thing of the past. That's an argument for bringing matters to a head sooner rather than later. And that's the mood Kennedy is in when they discover the missiles in Cuba. And so there's the Cuban business in October of 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, very important. What is important? You know, people look at it as this kind of separate crisis. It just kind of comes up out of nowhere, and then it's very dramatic, and then it's resolved, and then it disappears without leaving any further effects. Nothing can be further from the truth. This Cuban Missile Crisis is an integral part of the Great Berlin Crisis. It's the climax of the Great Berlin Crisis. All these tensions that have been building up in Europe, that are associated with the Berlin Crisis, these tensions come to a head in October of 1962. Why do we accept the crisis? Why do we make those kind of demands as sharply as we do? Because we want a crisis. We want a crisis because we know it's going to come anyway in a matter of months, and we want it to come sooner rather than later while we still have a strategic edge. Right? And the Cuban Missile Crisis is also a Berlin crisis. People say, why was the Cuban Missile Crisis resolved the way it was? It wasn't because of nuclear weapons or the nuclear balance. It was because the United States had local military superiority in the Caribbean, around Cuba. You know, America was much stronger. It's in our neck of the woods. What's the problem with that argument? It's like, well, the Soviets, it's true the Americans had local military superiority in the Caribbean. The Soviets had local military superiority around Berlin. What was to prevent them from responding to the American blockade of Cuba with a counter-blockade around Berlin? And then you're off and running with the Berlin crisis. So our policy of imposing a blockade on Cuba that tacitly amounted to our willingness to accept the possibility of a Soviet counter-blockade around Berlin and bring the whole Berlin thing to a head. And as I say, Kennedy and other people in the administration, they were thinking quite overtly in those terms. They understood the Berlin connections quite clearly, and it was an important element in shaping their behavior. Okay, you all know how the Cuban Missile Crisis developed. The United States basically made this demand that the Soviets withdraw their missiles from Cuba, and the U.S. blockade. Why is this important? Blockade itself is not going to force the Soviets to withdraw those missiles, but it's like the italics and exclamation point in the American ultimatum that those weapons be withdrawn. The American real policy was softer than it seemed to the public at the time, because behind everyone's back, the president sends his brother to tell the Soviets that if the Soviet missiles are withdrawn from Cuba, within 6 months we'll also withdraw our Jupiter missiles from Italy and Turkey. They made the false claim, to conceal the fact that this was a concession, that the president had already had previously ordered the withdrawal of those Jupiter missiles. The key thing is, whatever concessions were made, the Americans had insisted that Soviets withdraw their missiles from Cuba, and those missiles were withdrawn from Cuba. No counter-blockade of Berlin or anything like that. Why is the Cuban Missile Crisis important? There's this whole body of thought in contemporary political science that focuses on the importance of information. I think I might have mentioned this to you when we were talking about World War I, that book by Blaney called The Causes of War. Said, why do wars happen? Because there's a disagreement about what the true structure of power is. Right? Why are wars important? Because they reveal what the true structure of power is. They reveal they reveal important information. Right? And it's that new information that allows states to kind of create arrangements that are in harmony with the true structure of power, and thus are more stable. That's this argument. And James Fearon, in a very important article called Rationalist Explanations for War, came out about 20 years ago, developed that argument, formalized it in some very interesting ways, where the focus is still on the importance of information. You get problems because of the absence of common information or adequate information or symmetric information. That causes problems, and those problems get resolved when information is revealed. For example, in the run-up to a war, during a crisis. And in fact, crises that don't even end in war provide important information. And this Cuban Missile Crisis is an important case in point. What is it? What information does it provide? The Soviets, prior to this point, had wanted to create the impression that they were willing to risk war, that their policy was utterly intransigent. They're 10 feet tall. They're made of iron. Well, the upshot of the crisis revealed that they had been bluffing. They weren't as strong as they had been, whereas the Americans had been tougher than it had seemed in late 1961 or early 1962. When push came to shove, the Americans were willing to kind of draw the line, okay, and run a greater risk of war than the Soviets. Now, that important information shaped political behavior in the post-Cuban Missile Crisis period. Okay. Post-Cuban Missile Crisis period, how did it shape behavior? Okay. It made it possible now to kind of reach a kind of understanding or a set of tacit understandings that would provide the basis for a more or less stable international system for the rest of the Cold War. I'll explain to you why this point is important. There are all these myths about, why didn't we have a Third World War during the whole Cold War period? The great myth is, it's because of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are a force for stability, right? If in the absence of nuclear weapons, the whole Cold War would have escalated to the level of a Third World War. Thank God for nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are great. They're a force for peace. We shouldn't get upset when countries like Iran develop nuclear weapons. They're only good for deterrence. They serve as an anchor for peace. Very famous political scientist Kenneth Waltz made precisely that argument. Okay? What does this Cold War story show you? Yeah, 1963 was a watershed date. And the post-1963 part of the Cold War was relatively stable. The Cold War had become a political system. The threat of a general nuclear war receded into the deep background. People just weren't worried about it anymore. Cold War lost its apocalyptic edge in 1963. Why? Because nuclear weapons, you had nuclear weapons before. What you had in 1963 was the Soviets finally achieving nuclear parity with the United States. You know, this is the end of American nuclear superiority. We can't contemplate a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union in the event of a crisis. What does this tell us? If nuclear weapons are as important as people say, then the acquisition by the USSR of that sort of strategic position, now the equal of the United States, this should have led to a more aggressive Soviet policy, right, than the policy that they had pursued during the Berlin crisis period. But it didn't lead to a more aggressive Soviet policy. And in fact, Soviet policy became more moderate. What that suggests is that nuclear weapons could not have been decisive in that way. And that instead of what was going on in the military sphere being of such fundamental importance in that regard, we have to look toward what was going on in the political sphere for an answer to the question of why it was that great power relations became relatively stable from 1963 on. As I say, Cuban Missile Crisis, it revealed what the true interests, true resolve of each side in the Cold War actually was. And it paved the way for a set of understandings. Tacit understandings, implicit understandings. You got a question? Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly true. They were bluffing in 1962, right? The question is, whether they were bluffing in 1962 because they were so weak. They couldn't have a counter-blockade of Berlin after we blockaded Cuba because they were too weak to contemplate a true nuclear showdown with the United States. They themselves said, as a famous remark by one of the Soviet deputy foreign ministers at that time, says, "You Americans will never be able to do this to us again." In fact, within a year, they had developed this kind of second strike capability, equality with the United States. Why was it, after they had developed that position of strength vis-a-vis us, that they were no longer were inferior the way they had been, why was it that they didn't pursue a renewed aggressive policy from that stronger basis? Right? So yeah, they were bluffing when they were weak, but when they became much stronger, they could have pursued a tougher policy that would not necessarily have been a bluff. I mean, that's a puzzle. Yeah? Yes. True.
In which case, even though they now have sort of strategic parity,
yeah,
risking something like another missile crisis 35 years later is just as dangerous for both, right? Because even though the Soviets now won't be completely annihilated, they still don't have the ability to win that conflict. So it doesn't give them, I mean, it does give them slightly more leverage strategically, but not enough to give them the confidence to actually be able to show down.
Yeah. What's to prevent them from blockading Berlin after 1963? What's to prevent them from putting the squeeze on us in Europe? Right? They know that we're not going to respond to that with actions that run a risk of a general war that could lead to the destruction of American society. Their military position is strengthened. It could, in principle, support a stronger foreign policy, more aggressive foreign policy. In fact, their policy becomes less aggressive. Now that's it's a very important kind of obvious fact that you got to take into account when you're assessing these whole arguments about how nuclear weapons affect the way international politics works. Okay? The key point here is nuclear weapons aren't this kind of magic wand that brings stability to a system that otherwise would have been deeply unstable. They don't work that way. The reason you have stability is because of a set of political understandings that were reached, not because of the nature of what you find in the military sphere. Right? Political understandings. What are the political understandings? American policy doesn't change. We basically want the same sort of thing. We say we want the same sort of thing. The Soviets say, okay, let's sign on the dotted line. We realize that our previous policy is bankrupt, so let's reach a formal agreement. No, neither side wants a formal agreement. It's like, they don't want a formal agreement, basically admitting formally that their prior policy had been bankrupt. They like to keep things a little fuzzier. You know, they don't want to formally accept at this point the Western presence in West Berlin. After they had said all over and over again how this was a sore and an ulcer and this and that. The Americans, for their part, they don't want a formal agreement saying, in effect, you agree to respect our position in West Berlin, and we will agree in return to keep West Germany non-nuclear. The Americans don't want to do that because we want to be able to proceed in a softer, more subtle, more indirect way so that the policy we're pursuing is not so obviously directed at keeping Germany down. At kind of making a deal with the enemy at the expense of our ally, for fear of what that would do to Germany's loyalty to the West. So instead, the Americans propose, as part of a general deal, these arrangements having to do with non-proliferation. We want to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons because that policy is in the interest of all mankind. Not totally false, by the way. But it's not the central taproot of the U.S. policy. The policy is, in effect, directed against two countries, Federal Republic of Germany and the People's Republic of China. Our desire is to keep those two countries non-nuclear. We don't really care about other countries to anything like that extent. But to kind of keep Germany non-nuclear, it's much more palatable to Germans if we say that policy is just part and parcel of a policy designed to stem the tide of nuclear proliferation and to keep the nuclear genie in the bottle to the extent that we can, you know? And it's a semi-plausible rationale. Right? But when you look at the whole negotiation process, in the post-Cuban Missile Crisis period, you're struck by the fact that there's a clear juxtaposition when people are talking about these issues in these U.S.-Soviet negotiations and in the documents that are submitted. There's a juxtaposition between the German nuclear question, the Berlin question, the question of the stabilization of the status quo in Europe. You know, it's not like arms control is entirely separate from these kind of core political issues of we do arms control because it's in the interest of humanity. No, these arms control efforts are designed with political goals in mind. What are those political goals here? The political goal is to kind of reach an understanding with the Soviets that's in the interest of both sides. They respect our position in Berlin. We respect their kind of core strategic interest in Europe, which is the need to prevent Germany from going nuclear. And these things are tightly interconnected. The Germans try and resist this under Adenauer. We intervene in a very forceful way in German politics in January and early 1963, leading to Adenauer's fall from power. Kennedy goes over to Germany in June of 1963. Wildly positive reception on the part of German crowds, especially in the city of Berlin, in West Berlin, as though the German people are giving their approval to this U.S. policy. You know, all this stuff is quite extraordinary. And this policy, that both sides, U.S. and Soviets, accept, the great symbol of this is the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Treaty of Moscow of July 1963. See, this is like the tip of the iceberg. Everyone kind of looks at this, but what's important is what happened underneath the tip of the iceberg where no one could see it, which is all of these efforts that were made to link the German nuclear question with the Berlin issue and the question of the status of the two German states and so on. Germans themselves, as I say, they understand what the point of the Test Ban Treaty was, and they're pretty much made to sign it, forced to sign it, reluctantly. Okay, that's the centerpiece, that connection between recognition of the status quo in West Berlin and the acceptance of West Germany's non-nuclear status. That's the centerpiece of a political structure that comes into being, tacit, not embodied in any formal agreement, but based on a set of understandings that have taken shape in the process of a negotiation, that provides the basis for a relatively stable international order for the rest of the Cold War. It's rounded out in various ways. Just about one more minute. For example, there's the connection between Cuba and West Berlin. Kennedy himself realizes this. There's a parallelism here. It's like Cuba is vulnerable to American power the same way West Berlin is vulnerable to Soviet power. So each of these countries is like a hostage for the other. They move against West Berlin, we can retaliate in Cuba, and vice versa, by the way. Right? It's to our interest that the Soviets are exposed in Cuba the same way that the Americans are exposed in Berlin. These two things, as sources of weakness in the system, tend to cancel each other. And then there's the whole thing with the balance of payments. America has this big balance of payments problem. It's an artifact of the sort of international monetary regime that existed at that time, Bretton Woods regime. Right? We want the Germans to basically foot the bill, since they're a surplus country, financing the American balance of payments deficit, which they do. But in exchange for that, we make a promise to them that we're going to maintain an American force of a certain level on German territory for an indefinite period. You know, all these things, they're part and parcel of a political system. All right, let me end there now, and then I'll continue with all this stuff next time and deal with the 63 to 75 period.